Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and we've got a very interesting guest this evening. He's known worldwide as Freeman. His website is freemantv.com, and his YouTube channel can be found at FreemanFly. Freeman has been at the forefront of conspiracy theory for about two decades. He's internationally known. He's a TV producer, a filmmaker, a radio talk show host, a lecturer. He's considered an expert in the fields of the occult, in trauma-based mind-controlled, in Illuminati symbolism, and ancient civilizations. And I'm really so glad to have him on the show. Freeman, how are you this evening, sir?
Hey, Mark, I'm doing well.
It's very good to have you on. You're coming through great, and it's just a pleasure to have you on, sir. You know, I've been listening to you for years. Are you living in Kansas?
No, currently I'm in South Carolina.
Okay. And you spent a time where you traveled around the country back in 1993. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, honestly, I think, you know, there's two sides to the Freeman coin, right? One side is the conspiracy, the interest in the occult, the understanding of secret societies and the secret rulers of the world. And the other side is how to escape all that. And that really developed as the fact that I was just a nomad. And so once I graduated high school, I was like, I'm outie. And it was nothing for me to just jump in a van and just head nowhere. I had no idea where I was going or what I was going to do or how I was going to do it. And really, it all started where I started making juggling sticks. And I was making these juggling sticks, and they were the best in the world. I swear to you, they are. And people were buying them as fast as I could make them. And I thought to myself, well, I could do this anywhere. I could be in the park and just make juggling sticks and sell them to whoever's there, make 30 bucks and move on. And so I started doing that. Now, what was really odd about that whole scenario was I was beginning to come into the understanding of the world. I had just actually completed college at that point, and I was introduced to secret societies. I was introduced to Freemasonry and the Club of Rome and the ideas of social engineering. I was actually put through an honors course at Valencia Community College, set up by these very nefarious, what I would call nefarious people like the Club of Rome, teaching us limits to growth and the ideas that, you know, there need to be human habitat zones and all that kind of stuff. So the, you know, stuff they give you at the university, I just finished an honors course of that. And in the midst of all that, this guy started teaching me about things. I remember so well that he said, well, it's esoteric. And we all looked at him and said, well, what's esoteric? And he says, well, it means you don't know what it means. And we all laughed, you know, like, that doesn't make any sense. You're crazy. And this guy taught me a lot about secret societies, Freemasonry, the occult, and Aleister Crowley and all that stuff. And then I learned that my family was involved in all of these things because I'm looking at the signs and symbols he's showing me. And I'm going, wait a minute, I recognize that compass, square, and G thing. That's in my dad's top drawer. And he says, well, your dad's a Freemason. And I'm like, no, no way. He's not part of this craziness, you know, that you're telling me about this esoteric stuff, you know. And he's like, that's, you know, go check out for yourself. So I go ask Dad, right? I'm like, hey, are you really a member of the secret fraternity? And he's like, yeah, I'm a Freemason, worshipful master, raised in Kaiserslautern Lodge and, you know, and all the stuff. And then he suddenly drops on me, and I swear, you know, my whole life I've studied UFOs, Bigfoot, Bermuda Triangle, you know what I mean? Loch Ness Monster, all of that stuff from the time I grew up, and UFOs especially. And then my dad, out of the blue, this is after I'm in college, says, well, yeah, I was also in Project Blue Book. You know, I was stationed on a South Sea island, and any time flying saucers flew over, it was my job to report that. And I'm like, wait a minute, wait, hold on. You're telling me this is all real, like flying saucers are real, and everything that I've been studying is real, and you've been a part of this, and you've never told me. And he's just nonchalant, yeah, you know, this is all real, you know, and I was on the submarine with Jimmy Carter, and, you know, and I'm just like, oh, my God, now I have pictures of all that stuff. So, you know, it is, it's legit. I got, you know, all kinds of stuff from him on that. So here I am awakening to this new reality going, no way that any of this is real, but yet knowing that it is, seeing, obviously, the signs, the symbols, and things started clicking for me. But at the same time, I'm this free-loving guy that's just happy to be on planet Earth and having a good time. And so I start making juggling sticks and decide I can just wander the United States with them. And just as I'm getting ready to leave, a little black and white spotted dog comes pawing at my ankle. I turn around to see, I thought my friend was walking on me, and there's no one behind me. You know, there's no one, I feel this, but there's no one there. And it was this little dog. And I look at him, I'm like, hey, cool dog, hey, what's up? And, you know, see you later. And he takes off, runs around the corner. I go and I turn the corner. We're going to say goodbye to all our friends and about to jump in the van. I decided to take that crazy esoteric guy with me in the van. He never even left home before. And we go in to tell him goodbye, and there's that dog sitting there on their doorstep. Now, this is an apartment complex. There are numerous doors, and he's sitting on their doorstep that we're going to. We get there, and they're like, oh, my God, this dog is still here. He'd been sitting there for 3 days. And the thing of it is that once you start on your magician's path, on the idea of, you know, consciousness shift, the very first card is the Fool. And the Fool is depicted as a man stepping off a cliff. Now, is the Fool going to fall? Is he going to fly? It's that quantum moment before any of that. And at his ankle, while he's juggling off this cliff, is a black and white spotted dog that looks identical to the one that decided to follow me for the next 4 years. That dog jumped in the van with me without a question and just traveled and stayed at my heel for the next 4 years until I landed in Kansas. And then he just vanished. And at that moment, I ended up with that guy's entire magician's library, all of his books. He ditched the van. He freaked out. Most people can't handle being out on the open road like that. He freaked out. He panicked. He left. I was left with this entire magician's library. All of a sudden, now I'm sitting there on the next tarot card, which is the magician, and studying the occult esoteric cards. So that's how that all started.
So did you live out of your van?
I did, yeah. It was crazy. I would like, one of the first places I ended up was Washington, D.C. And there I was laying under the Washington Monument, sleeping on the lawn. I had never been there before in my life. And this girl yells out, Freeman. And I'm like, how? How is this possible? You know, this is before I'm known on the internet or anything. And I sit up. And there's a girl that I had sold a set of juggling sticks to at a flea market in Florida. Turns out she's the head archaeologist at the Smithsonian and takes me down into the basement of the Natural History Museum where I get to play with all the stuff that they're hiding from everybody else.
Wow.
And so my life just continued on an epic quest of stories like that that just kept piling on top. One thing led to another. And by the time I would return back to Kansas, where I decided to make my home, everybody would ask me, well, how did you do all of that? I mean, you've been to the mountaintops, you've been to California, you've been to Florida, you've been to Rainbow, you've been to this concert, that concert, you've done all of this stuff. How did you do all that? I mean, you don't have a job, you ain't got nothing, you certainly can't do that on juggling sticks. And I had no answer. I was like, I actually have no idea how I went and how I got to where I was going and when I got back. And I read the book The Celestine Prophecy, came out in 1996 by James Redfield. And it was psychology's understanding of man's consciousness in our modern era. And the book The Celestine Prophecy explained exactly how I was doing what I was doing and exactly how a friendship agenda would fulfill itself if people were bold enough to start to take this challenge on for themselves and go out and survive on nothing but friendship. And so I tried to prove that to a physical point. And for 2012, I took a school bus around the entire United States without a job, without any money, to prove the impossibility of that, because that's impossible, but I did it.
So tell us more about this book, The Philistine Prophecy. So it was telling you how you survived with no money, right?
Well, how the miracles happened, because when I would come back, I'd be like, I don't know, it's miraculous. I just ended up here and there. And like, for an example, I was needing to get to Florida to meet the purple school bus so I could get to Rainbow, I had to get to this jazz festival in Florida to meet my friends and get on the purple school bus to go to the Rainbow Gathering. And I had no idea how I was going to get there. I'm in a stranger's house. It's a bunch of deadhead hippies that I had never met before but had just ended up traveling with. And I'm in a stranger's house with these people, and they're all going different directions. Everybody's about to leave me, and I don't have a vehicle. All of a sudden, the phone rings, and it's this girl that needs somebody to ride with her to this jazz festival in Florida. And she needs someone to go, just for safety's sake. And here I am in the stranger's house getting a call to take me exactly where I needed to go. And over again, these scenarios would happen. We'd end up in Kansas and we needed to get to Colorado. My friend shows up and says, hey, I need to get to Colorado. I'll pay the way if you can get me there. And I said, yeah, but we got to make it to, again, another jazz festival. And they're like, well, that's where we're going. And it was just event after event after event of synchronicities. So the Philistine Prophecies by James Redfield, and synchronistically I ended up meeting him too, so I asked him about the book. And he said that, he was studying psychology at university and just decided to take the understandings they were developing and write it into a fictional story to help people learn these tools. And so the tools were that every one of us is a psychic vampire. And we are developed as such because he doesn't use those terms, by the way, but that's just the energy sucking that we do from one another is the main point of the whole system. So what happens is that in our youth, our parents control our control dramas. They create our control dramas. So if a parent is aloof, you might become an intimidator. And so psychology has seen that there are these four control dramas that work within humanity that allow us to suck energy from other people. And you can always tell when somebody's sucking your energy. And so you might be an aloof, you might be a poor me, you might be an interrogator, or you might be an intimidator. And you're probably a little bit of all, but there's one that's dominant. And you learn this because you need to get energy from your parents when you're young, and you learn different little skills to suck that energy from them, either being a poor me, whiny little baby getting the attention, or being rambunctious and crashing and being an intimidator, and you get that attention. And that is developed because of what your parents are. And so anyway, these are the tools that we learn to suck other people's energy. The only thing that fixes this is the idea of beauty. And so you surround yourself in beauty, you fill yourself full of energy, and then you have enough energy to share with the other people that all are trying to suck your energy because there is no beauty in the world.
Well, don't you think that's the problem? I mean, maybe the problem is that we've destroyed so much of the beauty in the world. I mean,
it's intentional. The artwork that you see in your parks and your malls, I mean, they're all mediocre. They're intentionally mediocre. It's psychological warfare.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, don't you think that nature has this tremendous beauty? And if we were all living in this, in the more of a natural surrounding, that we would all be filled. Like you said, it's very interesting the way you put it, that the beauty would fill us with the energy that we needed. I think that was very good the way you put that.
Yeah, and I would go to rainbow gatherings every year, and this is where 30,000 people gather together in a national forest in a unity mindset, but nobody's, you know, all individuals that all come in together. There's no formula for what is a rainbow, but it's complete primitive living, and people come there. I've stayed there for 3-4 weeks at a time, just living in the national forest with 30,000 other people. And everybody gets along. It's all beautiful. It's like, you know, the crime is there, but it's minimal. It's like the opposite of what you find in a money-based system. In Rainbow, everything's free. There's only two laws, really, and that is no alcohol and no money. And as long as there's no alcohol, no money, then you're all good. And so you eat for free. Everything's taken care of. And I have seriously seen this out of so many people that go to Rainbow, that once all your needs, your bodily needs, are completely satisfied, like, you know that if you get up and walk over here, you get to eat. If you go over here, you get to lay down. You go over here, you have water. All those needs are met without any of your action needed. You know, you don't have to earn it, basically. You start to release all that trauma that you've had from the system that we live in. And I literally see people start to convulse as those anxieties leave their body. It's crazy.
You know, I do think because we live in these cities and in unnatural environments that we are traumatized by that.
Yeah, without a doubt. Once you get out there, you know this. And as a nomad, I just, you know, I found beauty in humanity. I found wonder. I found wonderful people. And I never have, in all my travels, been in danger. I've never seen even that dark side of humanity in all the times that I've lived in. I lived in a van for a decade,
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
That's a long time. That's a long time.
Yeah, I was
time,
living
man.
In a van. I was living in a van in Austin when I started the Freeman Perspective.
Well, you were pretty close to Alex Jones then. Weren't you?
Yeah, that's how I learned of Alex. I moved to Austin. Strange story. I went to Austin because I became a glassblower. And South by Southwest, I went to go sell my glasswares at the concert. And I met this strange, unusual homeless man on the bus. His name was Zoe. I love Zoe. And he was like this greasy hair, wide-eyed, just, you know, a freaky kind of a homeless man that most people would avoid, but so happy and so friendly. And he came over to me and he says, "You're so interesting. I need to do your numerology. Can I do it?" And I'm like, "Sure, go right ahead." And so he starts doing my numerology and he starts saying, "You're the goddess. You're the goddess." And this, strangely, is the very next tarot card. And it became the basis of my study. I became the first expert on the goddess Columbia, the goddess of America. And it became my whole thing at that point. But that was off and beyond. That just happened. But so he starts talking about J.J. Hertak, right? I don't know. Do you know the Keys of Enoch? All right.
Oh, yeah. I've interviewed him. Yeah. Yeah. He's great.
Here's this fuzzy-eyed, greasy-haired old homeless dude discussing the Keys of Enoch with me, which just happened to be the only book I brought with me. And so he's tripping out by all of this, and he says, "Look, I'm going to get off on your stop, and I'm going to hang out with you a little while longer if you don't mind." I'm like, "Sure, I'm homeless too. Come on." He's like, "Where are you homeless?" And I was like, "I live on 37th Street, which is Christmas Light Street in Austin, Texas." And he's like, "Oh, well, I'm just two blocks from you in my van." And so a couple of days later, there's a note left by Zoe on my van saying I had to go to the mall and listen to this lecture. And I'm like, whatever. And he gave me the bus routes, you know, because you leave your vehicle and you take buses, right? So anyway, I was completely accepted by that entire street. They gave me free coffee at the coffee shop. All the neighbors were friends of mine now. You know, like, I'd lived in the street and was a neighbor of all the people, you know. It's like, so that's how I'm homeless, right? My homelessness is more like home free. Like, you know, I just don't have a house. but I have a bunch of wonderful friends and always a good time, and I'm eating in these gourmet backyard buffets that everybody has every night in Austin, Texas. I had a whole cycle. I would just go every night. And all those people ended up at that very talk in the mall. So I had met these random people at these backyard gourmet buffets, and then they were all at this lecture in the mall. Here I am walking into this weird small mall. There's no business. It's empty. I'm like, what am I doing here? And I walk into the middle of it, and there, sure enough, is a lecture. And so I walk in, and all of a sudden I realize I know all these people. Now, I am a practitioner of the Celestine Prophecy. I literally practice the insights openly and actively. So if you read the book, you'll see what I'm talking about. There's steps all along the way. And I practice these things openly. And most of the time I find other people that are also practicing them openly, the insights of the Celestine Prophecy. So when I ended up in that room with all people that I had already met, I wasn't exactly that shocked. Now, what it was a lecture by George Green, who is an ex-Bilderberger, ex-financial advisor of Jimmy Carter, same guy that my dad was on the submarine with. And he's telling us all about the Plajarans visiting Billy Meyer. And he's showing us the spaceships and how they have to park in the tree and how the magnetic propulsion systems work. Now, this guy is a Bilderberger, financial advisor to the president. Was a billionaire at one point, and now he is the publisher of the Plajarans book, Handbook for a New Paradigm. And he's handing them out free to everyone. So I'm sitting there in this lecture, and he starts showing the pictures of the Palladians and the Plajarans, and I look like them, right? I got this long, wild hair look, I'm a wild human, if you will. And so everybody starts kind of looking at me. So I decided to pretend to be a Palladian or a Plajaran, whichever ones you want to call them, because I've always kind of felt like I was a Palladian long before I knew anyone else thought that they were Palladians. I thought I was Palladian anyway. So I start pretending to be an alien, and I start telling these people the secret codes of the secret societies that I had unraveled and what it meant. Well, and the shock and awe struck Nebuchadnezzar using the Moabs, and how I predicted 9/11 and what these numbers mean and all of this stuff. I ended up telling all this stuff to Senator Bob Bowman at one point in all of this. Anyway, and he was freaking out. I'm talking to Senator Bob Bowman and his wife about these secret magical practices inside a military operation, and Bob Bowman says, yeah, we're well aware of all this, but we do our best not to think about it, right? So this is where my life is going now. I'm at a concert, but now I'm an alien at this conference or at a talk, and this tall dude walks up to me, and how I would have thought he was an alien. He was like 7 foot tall, blonde hair, blue eyes, and he comes over to me and says, you need a TV show. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, would you do it? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm only here for the weekend. I don't live in Austin. I live in Christmas Light Street in my van. He's like, would you do it? I will write you a check right now if you will go down to Access Studio and sign up for a television show. And I was like, all right. Let's do this thing. And he wrote me a check right there on the spot. And I'm a man of my word. So I went and I bought myself a computer. And I sat in my van. I eventually moved into a jazz band's house. And I created the first episodes of The Freeman Perspective, which, each half an hour took 4 months to create. And really? I had a show every week. Yeah. Because it wasn't like it is now. this is before nonlinear editing. This is crazy talk. I mean, my first videos are on VHS, right? people look at my videos from YouTube and they're like, this looks like it's on VHS. I'm like, it is. That was the technology of the time when I was working. I worked through that whole transition. As soon as I had linear editing down, everything went nonlinear. but you had to be a millionaire to get the editing software. It wasn't public use yet. So, yeah, it took months and months to create those half-hour shows. And that's how I ended up on television 5 years later. So Alex Jones is another part of that puzzle. He had to contend with me. I don't mean to ramshaw your show, but just to put this out there, Alex really had to contend with me because here I was. He would get up from doing his show, and I would sit down, right? We were in the same studio, same chair. And I kept trying to meet Alex. Yeah. I kept trying to meet him before I had the television show. And then I got this opportunity. I went through all the classes. I'm going to do my very first production. And there's Alex. And I'm like, holy shit, that's cool. So I walk over to him. And, of course, I got to jab him a little bit. So I said, I hear you're the only other one to predict 9/11. And he's like, well, I didn't predict the day. And I was like, oh, because I did. Right? So I'm like, and I was like, you know that the owl is not Molech, right? That's Columbia, the goddess, right? You understand it goes to Diana, Minerva, Columbia, Isis, back to Lilith, and that's the owl. It's not Molech. And he's like, yeah, I know, but it's already out there. But you'll see in his new film, he added the goddess part. That was my fault. And then everybody started telling Alex, why aren't you more like Freeman? You know, he's so calm. He's so nice. Why can't you be like... So Alex actually invited me out to Terror Storm, and we're sitting in the back of the theater, and he's like, see, I'm not yelling as much anymore, see? And I'm trying to tame it down. So I really had a huge impact on Alex Jones. Even his guest list changed. He started having David Icke on, Michael Cerian on, like the magicians and stuff. And that was all my gig. And so, yeah, he really had to deal with Freeman being on the same network.
Do you still live by the Philistine prophecies, or do you have a more down-to-earth life with a regular income now?
I haven't had a job since 1999.
No kidding. Everything just comes that you need.
Mm-hmm.
Still. That is
every
amazing.
Time. I've been to London. I've been all over England. I've been all over Australia, been all over Guatemala, and I never have more than $200. I spent an entire month in Australia, and I only had $200. And I spent an entire month in England, up and down London and everything. Even snuck into the AV2 conference and caused a giant ruckus. All with less than $200 when I was in England. I do it all on friendship, and it works. It totally works. So I built the friendshipagenda.com so that all the people that we met could then put themselves out there to everyone else as well. And it works. It really works. I have literally done this. I walked out my door, and I traveled the entire United States and then ended up back at my door again. And no plan, no schedule, didn't even know. I just went to the coffee shop. And I was off. I was on my way. It was crazy.
And is this a principle of the universe you're telling us?
Yes, absolutely. This is the principle of friendship, the principle of kindness, and the principle of beauty. And as long as you are a happy, enjoyable person, the first question out of my mouth generally is, what can I do? What can I do for you? And most people, you know, just need someone to hear them. There's so many lonely people out there and the beauty of it is so many times when I go to visit and I meet people at coffee shops, or now that people know who I am, I can just say, hey, I'm going to be here and 1,000 people come meet me, you know. But then what happens is all those people then become friends. So everywhere I go, I leave these pockets of people that never met. And they have a bond because they're all into my crazy whack theories, you know? And so I leave little pockets of friends everywhere I go, and then I generate this whole... Personally, I think friendship is a far better currency than gold. And I've tried to prove that all my life.
That's a huge statement. Did you spend some pretty cold nights out there in that van?
I have never suffered. I've tried to think of time... Now... You know, sometimes if you were to look at my life from one perspective, from a victim's perspective, you might think that I had a hard life if you were to look at it that way. But I never did. It was always an adventure to me. So even when I was standing on the side of a road eating cold beans while rain was pouring off my forehead into my plate, I was having a great time. So, but like there was a time I remember where I ended up alone. See, I always grab a person who's never traveled before and put them in the van with me, and they freak out. They panic because it's literally like you're out on the open ocean. But I've driven 100 miles and then had the person next to me say, "Where are we going?" Oh, I don't know. You know, pick a spot. You know, I've driven 100 miles down Highway 666 and then said, you know, heading south on 666 probably isn't a good idea. Let's go north. You know, it didn't matter. and how you keep a van going, I have no idea. I don't know where the gas came from. I don't know how it, you know, I didn't steal. I didn't beg. I didn't do anything like that, but I just kept going. People would get in the van. They would buy gas. They, you know, I never had an answer for how until, you know, until it seemed problems.
So if you did run out of gas, you would just sit there for a while until somebody would help you out and give you money or something like that?
Yeah, I don't honestly remember any scenarios like that in the van. I remember them in the bus. We had a couple of things like that where the bus just stopped. It just didn't go anymore. And I don't know jack about a bus. Here I am driving the 66-passenger school bus. You know, it's 2 tons. And you had to get a special license to drive the damn thing, you know. And it got 2 miles to the dollar. All right, calculate that, right?
That's
2 miles
horrible.
To the dollar, and we drove that thing. We ended up repeating the hippies trail, the Merry Pranksters. Now, we had no idea we were doing this, but the Merry Pranksters came from La Honda, California, I think it was, and then made their way to the World's Fair and then made their way back to California. And this was the big hippie trip with the, you know, painted school bus, the LSD and all of that, the Merry Pranksters. We ended up doing the exact Merry Pranksters trip, only in reverse. And we ended up doing a perfect sacred spiral through the United States without even meaning to. We were just being guided by whoever said, "Hey, come bring your big crazy bus to my house." And, you know, I'd get an email or whatever, and we'd jump, and we'd go, "All right, let's take the bus there." And the story I was really getting to is that it broke down. There we were standing there, and I'm looking in the engine. I find this part just sitting there. I don't know what it does, but it's not where it's supposed to be. And I turn around, and there's a guy behind me. He had just won the lottery. And he's like, "I'll fix this. I know everything about these engines." He takes me to his friend's house. They recreate the part. He buys all the parts and things, and they recreate them right there. And they go back and take me back, and he puts it all back together for me. Turns out he's an ex-NSA working. He was working in China, and he ended up winning the lottery. And, you know, so every time something like that happened, there was always somebody right there. And when you have all the time in the world, it's different. So there was a time when we first took the van, the very first time I took the van, went to Washington State, was a long, long drive. The transmission housing just sheared off and flew away, and you could hit the gas all you wanted. That van wasn't going anywhere. So we ended up at this bar. And I remember they said, "Well, you ain't in Fruitland and you ain't in Payette." And we're like, "Well, where are we? We only know where we ate." And but, you know, my friend panicked, and he's like, "I'm getting a bus. I'm going back home," and da-da-da. And I'm like, "No, I can fix this." He's like, "You don't know how to fix it." I'm like, "I know, but I'll fix it." And this old man took me into town every day, and for 3 days I learned how to put a new housing on a folks on a Dodge van, you know, and I put it back together. We never had park again. We had to tie it to trees or put a rock underneath the tire or something like that. But I got that damn thing going.
That's incredible. What a story. Do you think that somehow maybe we're all connected subconsciously somehow, and we just don't understand that yet?
I know that when I do a really good show, like, you know, talking with you, that I feel everybody else. Like, I can't sleep that night because I literally feel everyone thinking about me or thinking about the information, or I believe this. I don't know it to be true, but I definitely have an effect that seems to be coming from the outside. But yes, absolutely, we are all bonded like that, without a doubt. And when you open the passageways to synchronicity and these miraculous events that seem commonplace when described but are absolutely angelic when you're experiencing them, you know, like somebody phoning a stranger's house, taking you where you need to go. You're like, angels are watching over me. And so as a nomad, I no longer have a belief. I have a knowing. And I think that's why most religions come from nomads, because once you wander the earth like this and you have all these miraculous events happen again and again and again, you start to trust that. And it really makes
a difference. That's a very profound statement, because you're 100% correct. Historically, all the leaders of the religions are kind of nomads, aren't they?
Yeah, you know, the stories of Moses walking through getting manna from the land, I would consider this pretty much the same thing, only with gasoline, you know?
That's unbelievable. And you still live this way. I mean, that's just phenomenal.
Yeah, I'm never getting a job, folks. I can't. I am really seriously unemployable. I don't know. I could never go back. I couldn't do it. I'd rather be homeless.
No kidding.
But I'm not. I'm living fine. You know, I managed to learn how to do all the things that I do. I you know, I'm an honors student. I'm a hard worker. I've got an honors degree in university. You know, I'm not some slouch. I'm someone who says, oh, give me a TV show. Let me see what I can do with it. I want to change the world with what I create. And no one had ever seen anything like the Freeman perspective when I created that. It never existed, this ultimate perspective of reality.
It's very amazing, I think, the power of our thoughts. And I think that's one of the things you were tapping into, is the tremendous power of our subconscious and our unconscious thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah, I really think, again, as a nomad, as somewhat of a, not really a hermit, you know, you're alone, but you're never alone. But you got a lot more time to sense things. Like many of my, you know, like I see a chiropractor, and they're always shocked at how in tune with my body I am. For me, it just seems like, you know, normal. I know what's going on in my body, but then you learn, well, I guess that's not normal for most people, because everybody's lost in their quagmire of, you know, life.
Do you still sleep in your vehicle, or do you have a home now?
No, I have a home now.
Okay.
The last time we did the vehicle was the school bus, and that was an epic adventure, man. Like, wow. I mean, total hippie trip for sure, and the fact that we ended up doing the Merry Pranksters trip in reverse, that kind of seemed a giant symbolic gesture. Because I don't know, the whole mind control story really comes out of that Merry Prankster trip and the Grateful Dead and LSD and all of that. And so we kind of reversed it. And strangely now, we ended up in La Honda, California, and somebody gave me a book by Ken Kesey, who was the lead Merry Prankster. He's also the guy who wrote One Who Flew Over Cuckoo's Nest. Ken Kesey was one of the, you know, he was the main bus guy. And they gave me a book by him, and then it says in the book, and when I bought the bus in La Honda, we knew something special was about to happen. So we had actually just completed the trip to the point of returning to where the bus was bought by the hippies. I mean, it was astounding. I don't know.
That is that's amazing. So what are your thoughts on how history has been unfolding the past few years? It seems to me that our elected officials really do not have to follow the rule of law anymore. In addition, it seems like a larger and larger portion of the public is being brainwashed. You mentioned mind control there. Can you tell us more about that?
Oh, yes. It is so bizarre right now, because you can literally watch the mind control at work, and it's just astounding. You know, I've been opposed to Hillary since Waco, you know what I mean, since Mena, Arkansas, and the mysterious suicides and deaths around the Clintons, you know. I've been opposed to that family for so long. that when people are freaking out that she lost, I'm like, who are you talking about? You know, this is the scariest, spookiest lady on the planet. But, you
yes.
know, I understand. Donald Trump's a buffoon. You know, it's not like you get to win. I mean, what do you think? You already elected either Skull and Bones number one or Skull and Bones number two. When did you think you had a choice? Back when you elected the head of the CIA to be the president? You know, when was the time you thought you had a choice? And so this whole system of psychological warfare that I have been watching with social engineering, I took the 18 years of going back to Bill Clinton, and I predicted. Now, my wake-up moment really was the moment that they brought Bill Clinton before the public and said he inserted a cigar in his secretary. Now, he turned purple on the screen. I'm sitting there thinking, wait a minute, you don't do this to a president. You don't do this to your leader. This is a matter of national security. You can't make your leader look this weak. And they were just, you know, pummeling old Clinton in front of everyone, right? And so that moment for me struck a chord. And I said, okay, wait a minute. If this is psychological warfare and they're destroying the man, then the next thing they need to destroy is the system. So I said, the next thing they're going to do, and you can still see all of this on my blog, is they're going to force the president into office. And then I learned that there was this W running for president. And I said, it's going to be that guy. Because W, in the Kabbalistic practices of the secret societies, is the symbol of the fallen angel. It's the symbol of the abyss. And so I said, they're going to force that W into office, and they're going to make it obvious so that everybody gets mad about it, because they need you to lose faith in the system. And sure enough, that happened, and they made it obvious through Jeb Bush. And I said, all right, the next president's not going to be considered an American citizen, because they need a constitutional convention. They need to open
wow.
the whole system up so that it will fail, and they need everybody to believe in it. So the next president's not going to be constitutionally viable. He will not be an American citizen. And you can see this again on my blog. Before anybody had ever heard of Barack Obama, I said, you know, W is the last American president. And then the birther thing happened. And I was like, no, listen, guys, the birther thing is the psychological warfare. It's not the answer.
Right.
You're not, you know, you're playing checkers when they're playing chess. And they had Orly Tate out there being the head of this whole birther movement. She was a horrible speaker, hardly spoke English. And this is who you're going to champion to impeach the president? It was a ridiculous campaign that couldn't win. But what I did is I talked about all of this stuff right before the debate with Hillary and Trump. And I said, here's all the psychological warfare effects that I see, the social engineering that I see going on. And every single one of those was highlighted in the debate. From the bringing four of the rape victims of Bill Clinton to the stage for announcing that the candidates were illegitimate, every aspect of the psychological warfare I was talking about was a primary spot in this debate, and it was intentional. It was obviously intentional. I called it all before it happened. It's crazy.
That's incredible.
So that's how, you know, I see it as psychological engineering that is causing people to react to a situation, you know, Hegelian dialectic, all that. We're playing checkers while they're playing chess. And they're, you know, going ahead with their schedule, and we're following right along. When we were in the school bus, I went to every single Occupy there was in the United States, and I scolded them all for wasting their time out here. I told them to get up, get out, and go to put some garden in the inner city. If you want change, don't sit here and look like a hobo on the street having everybody frown at you. Get out there, start growing some food. Liberate the people. And, you know, if you're going to spend 3 months sitting here, you could have a damn well good garden going already. And I went to every Occupy and I told them. Yeah. But, of course, you see that
so,
with all set up, too, you know.
What do you think? Do you think they're trying to create a civil war in the United States? What's going to be their next move?
Yeah, they already have. I mean, I was actually just invited to go to the inauguration ball with Sean Young, the actress from Ace Ventura. we've become good friends now, and she needed a partner to go to the inauguration with. So I thought in a couple of days I was going to actually be in the middle of that madness. But she canceled, thank God, at the last moment. It was kind of an itch thing. She didn't know she wanted to go into a riot either, you know. We're both like, yeah, I don't know. But anyway, so I'm not going. But, yeah, you can see the civil war is already happening, and no one knows what, you know, is it Russia, is it CIA, is it FBI, is it Hillary, is it, you know, who's the madman here? We got to get the bad guy. And there is a civil war going on. It's really quite insane. And that's what I mean when I say you can see the mind control. Because nobody's winning here, you know.
So you think the Illuminati, I'm assuming you're saying the Illuminati then wants to create a civil war in the United States.
Okay, I'm really reluctant to use term Illuminati, although I use it in my blog so that it gets hit. But it gets diffused. Because there is no Illuminati by name. And this was Anthony J. Hilder who started, you know, kind of calling it collectively the Illuminati. So you've got actually a basis of different secret societies that are kind of battling for ultimate control. And right now you can see the Jesuits are very poised. They are very well inundated in the concepts of the extraterrestrial invasion. They're the ones running the Lucifer, well, they don't run the Lucifer telescope, but they use it at the Vatican Observatory, you know, the Jesuits. And so for the first time ever, we have a Jesuit Pope. Now, the whole story of Pope Benedict and the fall of Ratzinger is another whole nother show. But now we have a Jesuit Pope. First time ever in the history of the Catholic Church is there a Jesuit Pope. And he's from Naziville, Argentina, you know, where George Bush and everybody have all of their ranches to go to at the end of the world, in Paraguay, Argentina, Chile, where all the Nazis went, where Mengele has a town of twins there in South America, blonde-haired, blue-eyed twins. You know, that's where all the elite have their ranches for this end game, like the Bushes in Paraguay. That's also where they create glow-in-the-dark sheep. Which is, you know, whatever. that's our planet now, you know. Paraguay, you can get glow-in-the-dark sheep in Paraguay. That's true.
But now, you mentioned Jesuits. Are the Jesuits somehow related to your father being in this sub with Jimmy Carter?
There is an infinite war that's been going on from the Jesuits and... or basically really the Catholics versus the Freemasons. And so America is a Freemason-born nation. Everything that we think is America is actually Freemason. Like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was actually life, liberty, and the pursuit of profit was the original Freemasonic phrase, but it got updated for the American phrase. So, you know, the reason there's pentagrams in the street plans of Washington, D.C., that's Freemasonry. The reason there's a Capitol dome in every capital, that's Freemasonry with an obelisk. And so there are many, many nations like England, America, Australia, that are Norway, that are run by the Freemasons. And then there are these Jesuits that are infiltrating all these different layers. Then you've got the deep, dark occultists, like the Ordo Templi Orientis, Aleister Crowley's group, and they are at the heart of transhumanism and homosexuality and all those type of transitions into the system of, well, what they call the Age of Horus or the Age of the Crowned and Conquering Child. And that's where they're bringing us. So you've got all these different secret societies that all kind of are similar but fighting one another in different ways but using magical practices all along the way, and that's where our society is formed, our civilization, I should say.
Are they trying to push us into kind of a tyranny type structure?
Their planet is so weird, but yes, you know, for the main ones, when we are looking at somebody like Hillary or these which I consider trauma-based mind control, victims and agitators. You know, like Hillary was a victim that became an abuser, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And
yeah.
We've seen clear signs of Bill Clinton under mind control, speaking as if he were a six-year-old child, you know, being in a hypnagogic state, things of this nature. We've seen this, right? And we, like Kathy O'Brien, she's a good friend of mine, and so she was, you know, abused by Hillary. I'll be talking to her very soon. But there's those people, and those are the ones that are really in charge right now, are this satanic group. And that's when it all starts to get weird. This is how I predicted 9/11, how I predicted W, how I understood what shock and awe meant, because these are satanic symbols. And they're symbols of the abyss and the fallen angels. And when you start to see that, then you're like, wow, who are these guys and what are they dealing with? And you constantly find, like, say, the Nazis. You find that they are psychical research groups getting into ancient history and even ancient history and ancient civilizations like Atlantis. All Freemasons in their works talk of Atlantis. The Theosophy, they talk of Atlantis and these ascended masters. So with the Nazis, you've got this psychical research society that decides that they're going to form a political party, and that becomes the Nazi Party. They are actually practicing magical rituals to invoke entities into their souls, and they're building massive structures for this purpose. I mean, there's buildings downtown New York that are specifically built like Ghostbusters to channel entities into the souls of people. You don't believe me? This guy is the guy, Nicholas Roerich. He's the one who put the pyramid on the dollar bill. He talked with, was it Wilson? Into putting the eye in the pyramid on the dollar bill. That was Nicholas Roerich. He has a building downtown that they built for him that is built to channel these entities in. And so you start using all these different forms of magic, you know, the necromancy coupled with geomancy, and you get, you know, what these guys are really about.
So you got the Freemasons versus the Jesuits. Are they both bad guys?
Well, you know, I kind of go with Kennedy on that one. You know, in any society, secrecy is repugnant. Now, there is something to be said to the rituals. I have studied in depth the rituals of Freemasonry. I know them better than most Masons know them. And this is how I can use that knowledge to decipher the corporate logos that I see and tell you what they mean, because they all refer to an aspect of Masonic ritual. So the ritual itself, to me, is actually something that's really missing from humanity, that rite of passage. We've eliminated that. We no longer become men in our world, and we stay these stunted children, which is what Crowley said the age of Horus would be. So without this rite of passage of becoming men or women, we aren't growing, and we're not, you know, transcending our youth and into another being. So the rites and rituals that you would experience inside a lodge like that are very much these rites of passage. And they're somewhat terrifying, even though some people have been hurt, but, you know, generally you come out of them unscathed. But you will get rolled up in a carpet and buried in the furniture of the lodge for a time while you're in the ritual. And you can't move, you can't, you know, see, and you're blindfolded, they got swords. And they're making all this ruckus around you until they resurrect you, and you go through. So that's one thing to be said about secrecy. A ritual like that wouldn't work without secrecy. But then what's the point and purpose of this secret organization? I know men that have gone through all these rites and rituals and come out of it with nothing, you know, just the experience. It's not like they learned something from it or gained. Okay, I just wanted to say that about secrecy, but yet when you've got people that have alternative agendas and are controlling humanity through magical practice, which really is the television, because if you look into the history of television, you'll find it comes from the magical order of the Golden Dawn, and that's where you got your cathode ray tube and they were trying to send transmissions into the aether, which was the Maltese cross, and that's how television came to be. The guy who actually turned this into television said he would never let his family ever watch this thing. And then the Nazis, Telefunken, the Nazis decided they would put a television in every home, and so Telefunken became the major corporation. Now, they created the first computer. They created the FM, or discovered the FM band and how to use it, and they created television for everybody's use. And Telefunken is now AEG, who puts on many of your country western concerts and produces much of the music that you see. That's the same company, Telefunken. They're just called AEG now. And it's Nazis. You know, the Nazis didn't lose their corporation. And if you look at the ancient forms of magic, the very first forms of magic were contracts and talismans. And so what does our system function on? But talismans, which are the dollar bills. Now look at the psychological warfare that's going on with the bill right now. Now, first of all, 1996, they changed all the money. They changed everything but the first dollar bill, the $1 bill, because the $1 bill has all their magical pentacles on it. So they're not going to change that major spell. But the other bills were up for, revision. And in 1996, they made the bills that fold in to show you the Twin Towers burning. Right? Those were crafted in 1996. And then now they've reshaped the money again, and every bill is actually the color of Monopoly money. Right? So now your fives are pink, or green, or then the tens are pink, and the colors of exactly of Monopoly money. Now this is, again, psychological warfare. If your money looks like play money, your mind now says it's not real, and you're getting ready to move into the chip system, and, they want you to not think of that bill as real anymore. So that's the type of magic that these guys are using against them.
It's all psychological warfare, isn't it?
Yeah, magic, literally defined, is a change in consciousness through will that therefore alters the manifest world. And so that really is the ultimate definition of magic, and that is exactly what we see. So contracts and talismans, we got the dollar as the talisman. The contracts are these infinite golems that they create that we call corporations. It takes three magicians, a president, a vice president, and a secretary, to form a contract to create an immortal being that now has more rights than most of the humans on the planet, and has managed to buy all the water and resources the planet has to offer. And these things don't even exist except for in the magical realm. But we call them corporations, give them a name, they're a thing,
Well, Freeman, I want to thank you for coming on. We're already out of the whole hour. Please tell the listeners about your websites and your movies and everything like that, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Mark. Thank you so much. This was a good time. I feel like I feel your audience. I'm serious about that. So I feel like I'm talking
good
to all of you guys out there. I hope you feel that way too.
Yes.
FreemanTV.com is like my ultimate art. I have been working on FreemanTV.com for 10 years. There's so much stuff on there. There's so much back data. And what I can say is there's no such thing as an old show. I've interviewed the Twin Tower architect that is a Kabbalist magician that designs time machines. He was the guy that was there when the bin Ladens came in and asked where to put the demolition charges. I talked to that guy, right? I became friends with that guy. He's dead now. But so I've been exploring this really bizarre thing that is the esoteric world and the synchronistic world, and I've gone to every Masonic lodge and all the magical world, and I share all this with you in videos and pictures and blogs, and it's really been an epic and amazing ride, and I love FreemanTV.com so much, but realize it's super thick, so people are like, this is really difficult. I'm like, it's a university in there, man. 10 years or 12 years, I've put something new on the internet every week. for 12
wow.
years. I've been on the internet since the internet was the internet, you know? And, I'm really enjoying the position that I've been put in. And my last message to you would be not to think too hard about your future, but to allow it to unfold, because I would have never, ever thought of doing what I'm doing.
Wow. Thanks, Freeman.
Yeah.
We'll talk
Thank
to you,
Mark.
Again, sir. Have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Bye.